Hi. We're back for after the break. Our panel is made up of the four speakers from earlier, with the addition of Jim Minto and John Beryl, who together with John make up the NDIR panel. Just to introduce Jim first. Jim is the Managing Director of Tower Australia, which is the third largest life insurer in Australia by premium, and he has a broad background in health, life, general and managed funds. John Beryl is the principal at Maurice Blackburn and is the head of the largest national plaintiff superannuation and insurance claims practice in Australia. And he was a consumer rep on the Financial Industry Complaints Service panel and board up until 2009. And he's got a lot of other stuff on his CV, but let's get into it. As I say, we've got quite a lot of questions through on the SMS. We're also going to do questions from the floor. Am I correct? Yes. The SMS questions are under the cloak of anonymity. Questions, put your hand up if you want to raise a question from the floor and a mic will be delivered somehow near you. Good, thanks. But not yet. this is meant to be, I want to try and promote some discussion among the panel. We had my feeling listening to the presentations this morning is that there is a divergence of opinion in response to John's paper, but there is, to some extent, I think the different sectors are coming toward the same solution, but from different angles. So what I want to do, I think what will be useful for the panel is for us to sort of tease out some of the differences and get some response from the speakers to the other speakers' presentations, and then hopefully, then we'll go talk, raise some of the questions that you've asked, and then hopefully towards the end we can start seeing some sort of a collusion of desired outcomes, sort of some bringing together the disparate masses. So I think we've got three microphones between you six guys, and so just they're all on. So just go for it. I just want to start, get some discussion going among the panel, and then we'll turn to the questions that we have that you've put forward. And I will give some precedence to the questions from the floor in a little while. So I'd just like to start with Rob Whelan. I think you've presented well the industry perspective, and there is, but there were some aspects of what you were saying that I think would come across as different from what Gerard was saying, representing the consumer perspective. I mean, Gerard was saying that there was a lot of undersurance and non-insurance out there, and in particular, so we've got the sadly ironic position that those who need insurance most are those most unable to afford it. And I think I can reflect your feelings, Gerard, and say that without some action, the flood premiums will have become unaffordable for a lot of people who would really gain from having insurance. I'd just like to, if you could respond to Gerard's points.
Sure. Is that on? Yeah, okay. Look, Gerard's done a great job with the Brotherhood. We've actually worked together on a number of occasions to try and resolve some of these issues of non-insurance in the less well-off parts of the community. And renters are a key issue there, and I do think the industry needs to try and respond to that. And a very good report's just come out on this from the Brotherhood, which I commend to you all to read. Just in terms of the flood situation, I think it's important that we address the issues around availability of flood cover to those who are most at risk, and one would have to postulate that a reasonable proportion of those who are least able to afford some of the higher-end premiums that would occur if they were properly risk-rated. That's why we proposed that a possible solution to that is, and it's also in the issues paper, is a subsidy, some form of subsidy, so that the individual can affect insurance with an existing carrier, but then where the level of premium is beyond their capacity to pay, and there are various mechanisms to go about determining that, then some form of subsidy is provided by government. And as I mentioned in my paper, that there's something in the order of $3.6 billion collected in stamp duties alone by state governments every year. So there are funds available out there that come from policyholders already. So I think there are ways in which that issue can be addressed and people can actually avail themselves of sufficient cover, but there has to be some responsibility on them too to go out and seek that cover and provide the evidence or the case that they need the subsidy. The second point of that is that any payments that get put into that process, whatever it might be, also have to be tied to actions and activities that actually reduce the problem over time. Because if they're just a form of subsidy, then you have the moral hazard issue going forward, that people don't take the necessary actions to resolve the true drivers of the risk, which is having inappropriate development in at-risk property land.
So, Rob?
Yeah.
You put your mouth to the other end.
So, Rob, does that only apply to existing properties, not to new properties?
Well, look, certainly we've got a stock that we have to deal with now where there are still a small percentage but large numbers of residents that need to be dealt with. It would make sense to me, and I would assume the governments, local, state and federal, that you didn't actually add to that stock. So in any development application, why would it not be reasonable to put the onus on the developer to understand the level of risk that that particular area has, that they have to take action to put in mitigation works before the development is actually approved, or that they fund those mitigations and that's reflected in the price? There's no point in having cheap available land that is essentially going to go underwater at some stage, and that's unfortunately what's happened in Queensland to a large extent, because if you remember, over the last, I don't know, 10, 20 years, that was the highest growth area in the country in terms of population growth and residence growth. So urbanisation there has been massive. Why? Because there was cheap, available land. The unfortunate fact was it was on a floodplain, and everyone got reminded of that just recently.
Rob, the pie charts that you showed in your presentation, you know, with the 54% of policy of coverage which included flood insurance, where there were 15%. Yep. That covered insured households, correct, clearly. And I just was wondering, Gerard, with your presentation, you were talking favouring an automatic flood cover. And I just wondered how you respond to Rob's presentation where Rob is talking about the market is and is increasingly in the future providing the required cover.
Sure. Look, I would acknowledge that the insurance industry has done a lot to improve access to policies that include coverage of flood. But when we've got a situation when 54% only of the policies that are out there that include that coverage, I wouldn't say that we've gone far enough. That there are, denied claims of 15%, that does indicate, which is a lot larger than other disaster events. I would say that a lot of those people weren't aware or didn't understand that their insurance policies weren't covering flood, and that cause for concern.
I just wonder about the 54 and the 84%, Rob. I mean, it's quite impressive where we've gone from 2006, was it 3%?
2006, yeah.
To 54% today, and I'm quite impressed with and a little confused about the going to 84%. Because as you said, we have a large mitigation, a lot of mitigation needs. I mean, and you've also said that there are a lot of data issues. And it seems hard for insurers. Insurers will naturally say we can't price a risk we can't measure. So if we've got... We recognise now that there are a lot of houses at high or medium risk, and we recognise and you recognise that there is a lack of data for them. I'm not sure how we can encourage them to get to, how they can get to 84% coverage, given that by 2013 we're not going to have good flood data and we're not going to have those mitigation issues in place.
Okay. We're working the problem in tandem. Partly we've achieved a very high level of flood information through the NFID database, the National Flood Insurance Database. And that, as I pointed out in my slide, has covered the vast majority of catchment areas. I think it's 5 million residences in catchment areas or properties across Australia. The area that's least mapped or available to the database is Queensland. I think only 17% of catchments in Queensland are mapped. And that's because not that the maps don't exist, it's because the councils won't release them. So state government some time ago devolved the responsibility for flood mapping and flood mitigation in local council areas to local councils themselves. So it's a very much a cottage industry approach to this fundamental issue from an infrastructure point of view, that we really don't have the excellence, if you like, of a national flood information database that is constantly renewed and reviewed, so it's up to date, and that is perhaps more sophisticated in the level of data that it has. Now, that's a limitation, but I can tell you that I've had very strong assurances from the major insurers and others, but the major insurers, that with available information, as it's growing, and it's currently growing within NFID now, that by that time frame that I mentioned to you, 2012-13, that more than 80% of available policies in the marketplace, household policies, will cover flood.
I just want to follow through on that, Rob. The more than 80% will provide flood, but I think a key word missing from there is affordable. And that is the challenge, because if someone's premium increases fivefold or tenfold from one year to the next, as the data improves, you know, I think that is it's clearly there may be an issue with a tendency to push people towards underinsurance or non-insurance.
Yeah, it is a problem. Once you truly risk rate at the extreme end of the risk scale, those premiums will escalate quite dramatically. Albeit not at the present state, they're not at that level yet. But I assume as more information comes into the marketplace, and we have reinsurers also taking a much more detailed interest in this, given the losses that they've incurred over the recent past, that requirement for true risk rating will occur. Now, in that instance, I guess we do have an affordability problem, but we have an affordability problem anyway. The issue of riverine flood in Australia has, in terms of its cost, a bill of $400 to nearly $500 million per annum every year. So someone has to pay somewhere along the line. We have an affordability problem per se, whether it's borne by an individual or borne by a government or borne by an insurance industry. It's still an affordability problem. The only way you resolve that is to attack the drivers of the problem. That's what my presentation was about, was trying to disaggregate the problem down to what actually drives the problem and stop it growing and actually solve it. And that's how you get rid of the affordability issue.
I think everyone who would agree, everyone does agree, that significant mitigation efforts would be beneficial and are necessary, and building codes moving forward that recognise issues. I think you recognise, is a longer-term solution. And I want to follow that up with Daniel. I think the actuaries seem to be kind of having a bob each way, if you know. And I just wondered if you could just respond to Rob's presentation about the need that they're saying the need, the primary focus should be on the mitigation, and particularly whether or not you see there is a shorter term need that can address what the problems that we have now.
Actuaries always have it Bob each way, so no one will be surprised in that. Look, I think we definitely see mitigation. If we're limiting, if we're just talking about flood, there are houses that just aren't sustainable. They just can't be there. So yes, we need mitigation as a priority. That's a difficult issue. Obviously, requires strong government and a political will to upset people. So we certainly don't shy away from the fact that it's a very difficult task, but one that ultimately needs to be followed through. So yes, we support that, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. What is going to happen tomorrow? Well, if we had a flood tomorrow, we're going to have largely the same problem we had a few months ago. So we're of the view that we really do need to consider what measures get put in place to make sure that there is affordable cover for people. Exactly how you put that through, we have debated. I think from Rob's presentation, the only real difference between arguably some of the proposals in the issues paper and where the Insurance Council is coming from is the compulsion for insurers to act. It's more a matter of them being able to act and respond of their own accord and as markets allow them to, rather than having compulsion in any sense or sort of automatic cover and the like thrust upon them. I suppose what you're relying on there is the goodwill of the insurance industry. I don't doubt that there isn't goodwill at the moment. Can it happen quick enough and can it happen deep enough in terms of impacting the people who just can't afford any increase in premiums, let alone a 50% increase and those sorts of things? There are a lot of people who live week to week, and I think we need to try and make sure that any solution we put through addresses the issues that those people are going to face as well, and arguably a private sector solution doesn't help those people.
Yeah, thanks. I just want to follow up on one of the ways of structuring the options put forward in the issues paper is for there to be some sort of government-sponsored reinsurer set up. And I read somewhere that Australia pays about 2% of the international reinsurance premium over the last few years, and we pick up about 7% of the reinsurance claims that have been paid, which kind of makes me proud to be Australian in some ways, but I think the signals that we're getting from the reinsurers is that there will be significant increases in reinsurance premiums, and there will be, the reinsurers are very much aware, we were so uncorrelated with the international risks, you know, with Florida and stuff, that, you know, it's a little bit whatever about Australia, but it's changing, and there will be a focus on the insurers, Australian insurers, understanding their own flood coverage, especially if we do increase to something like 84% coverage, Rob. And I just wondered why the industry thinks about the option. If international reinsurance offer becomes very expensive, isn't it to the industry's advantage, Rob, to have some form of national reinsurance offering sort of more affordable premiums without some of the less of the cost of capital issues?
Well, for obvious reasons, I'm a bit more of a free marketeer than I am a subscriber to government intervention. I don't know how that would be structured and what the cost of reinsurance would be through a government pool. I think Australia has benefited from relatively low reinsurance rates for some time now. For a number of reasons around the world, reinsurance capital markets, but I think those days are gone, so we can expect substantial increases coming through there, I think, into the foreseeable future. How a government would be able to provide lower risk or lower cost capital on a sustainable basis to underwrite this risk going forward, I have a question about that, because someone has to pay the cost of capital eventually, and my guess is that has to come back to the taxpayer at some point in time. So anything that government does that actually is at a discount to the market means someone has to pay the subsidy, and that subsidy would be the taxpayer, I would assume.
Thanks. I want to... While we're getting the mic up here, I just want to ask John Beryl to respond to something Gerard said about the transparency of the insurance coverage. Just what you've found in your investigations around disclosure of coverage.
Well, we've had many views put to us about that, and I don't think it's a secret to say that the level of understanding by consumers about what they're covered for, particularly flood, but it's not only flood, it's all other forms of risk in a policy that runs to 50, 60 pages long. There is a disconnect. People simply don't read this stuff. They don't read it at any great detail. You take out your policy over the phone, you get sent it in the mail. You don't sit down and read it. Everybody's got busy lives. They don't sit down and read it. They put it away in one of those fan folder thingos, and that's where it stays. Yeah. You may look at, and this is part of the debate that the government's promoting now about coming up with a solution to disclosure, about not only a definition of flood, which I think is, it's sort of important, but that's not the big ticket item. I think the key features statement, this is my view, that key features statement is more the important issue around consumer awareness of what they're covered for, key elements of what they're covered for, and in particular, I suppose, flood versus storm. That's the thing that could have some impact on this under awareness by consumers of what they're covered for and what they're not. We're the consumer representatives that we've met, and we've met a number of them, including Jared, on a few occasions now. The message has come through loud and clear that a lot of people don't understand this stuff. But part of it is because of inertia. They don't sit there and read this stuff. I mean, I'm involved in superannuation as well, and through the discussions about my super and the stronger super stuff, and it's the same thing. At least in insurance, it's a product that people select. Superannuation is another step removed. It's a product that's foisted on them. So this whole consumer disconnect to what the fine detail of of these products is a big, big problem. And these key feature statements, I think, are a very important part of that. And the government's responded to that, and the ICA certainly responded positively to that. So hopefully we get a good outcome from that. We have had some input into that process, and it's certainly part of part of what we'll be looking at in the final paper we put. But if anybody's got any ideas over and above what's been the government discussion paper that went out on this stuff, then please tell us.
Gerard?
Can I just make one additional point to that? I think John's exactly right. People might know, surveys done by the Bureau of Statistics about levels of document and other forms of literacy amongst the population. And it always surprises me, and I think it surprises everyone else, how, illiterate a lot of the population is. And it's not only, those with low income and non-English-speaking background, but that those surveys say that 40% of Australians, adult-aged Australians, don't have the literacy levels to fill in a basic sort of form, that there might be a tax form or something. So I think remembering that when we design, policies around disclosure is really important.
Yeah, I'm in that 40%. I can't stand it. But it is a problem in this. I mean, we work in an industry that sells products for profit that also are a social good, and that's a complex balance that will always be with us. We have a question from the audience.
Thank you. Yes, Chris Trimblett from JLT Insurance Brokers. Firstly, congratulations to the committee for the report they put together, a paper. It's excellent. I think what this draws out is there are so many issues here, huge amounts. So I'm looking to see if the review panel is going to suggest some sort of priority be given to all these issues. I think they have to put some priority, some things in priority order, and obviously looking at the end consumer as being the first things they look at to make it easier for them. Some of the short-term issues might be looking at water rather than flood as a whole. So we're getting some sort of subsidy without getting a government subsidy. We're really subsidising from the existing insurance people that insure. So if we looked in the short term at having water covers, so whether you, as a lot of people would say, oh, the basement's flooded from a broken pipe, well, okay, there's immediately we have that problem with flood again. Well, what does it mean? But if we attacked it on water only to start with until we could get the flood information, until we could get the right risk-related information, I think we'd be in a better position. I'd like to also just say about the terrorism pool, maybe this could be made a disaster pool, and the monies coming from stamp duty fire services levy removed or maybe phased out and phase in a disaster levy to replace it, that way making sure the money does get to where it should be going. There are just so many issues. I don't know whether you want me to keep going, but, for example, the sum insured on buildings, maybe the easier way to look at this is looking at the market value of the property. Okay,
that's a really interesting issue that the paper covers, is whether coverage should be of sum insured or replacement value. So can we just hold that, the rest of the thoughts? And I'd like Gerard and Daniel and Rob's 20 cents worth on that issue. Is what is appropriate cover? What is optimal cover? Is it sum insured or replacement value? And is there an opportunity to push insurers or encourage insurers in a particular way?
I guess I can start with that. I think from the consumer's perspective, the replacement value cover is much more optimal, much more beneficial to a consumer. I saw a question just, there was SMS before around this issue, saying that where did the 5% increase in policy costs come from that I mentioned in earlier, and that came from the issues paper, and I think it was from insurers talking to the panel where that figure came from. So it may not be as a costly change as other people might think. I don't know those figures, and I think that consumer reps have been talking a bit with the industry about this issue and to get a better understanding of the modelling of the different sorts of costs that might be involved with total replacement versus sum insured policy, and there isn't a lot of information around there. But from a consumer's perspective, I would say that obviously the total replacement is going to cover them when they thought that when the actual full disaster happens, that they are covered.
I might have Rob, and I might finish with you, Dan.
Yeah, total replacement policies are available in the marketplace, but I'm not sure that they're only at a premium of 5%. My understanding is it's vastly more than that. And the complexity with total replacement is you don't have a precise price to be able to price the premium against, because when you have disasters, you have to make assumptions around what level of total write-offs that you'll have for a home in your pricing of a total replacement policy. If you have blowouts like we did in the bushfires in Victoria, where we had a very large number of total write-off or total destruction homes, then that alters the way in which you have to adjust your assumptions going forward. The other thing is you get claims inflation and you get new building codes usually after a disaster, which adds to the cost of the actual rebuild. So you'll find that your assumptions are usually blown out of the water at that point as well. So all those factors, it's not an excuse, but it simply means it's very hard to sustain those sorts of policies in the marketplace at affordable prices, because those assumptions build on each other and eventually you start to price it into the premium to the point where it gets quite expensive. So I'm not sure it's as quite a smaller premium of 5%. My guess is it's vastly more than that.
Daniel, you...
No, I don't think I've got anything really to add to there. I think I agree. From a consumer's perspective, you just want your property rebuilt. From an insurer's perspective or a funding perspective, the lack of certainty that you've got when you're taking out the, when you're underwriting the policy is quite extreme, particularly we've seen with the Victorian bushfires, the change in building codes. And one of the disappointing things about this is as soon as it starts to become a financial aspect, the improvement in building codes gets weakened or watered down or argued against because of the cost to implement these things. I can see that insurers with replacement value in these sorts of events would start arguing against changes in building codes because they don't want to have to pay out higher amounts on the policies to replace them.
Could I just come back on thing there? The idea I was putting forward, I guess basically was looking, because I challenge anybody here to tell me how much to rebuild their house. I bet you don't have a clue, or you wouldn't get too close to it. So what you can get close to, though, is when people sell houses, they go to real estate agents and they get a rough idea. That's what I'm meaning market value, but I'm meaning for the insurance companies to settle in a reinstatement replacement. Okay, the rates may have to change because clearly you've got land and all other sorts of things within that cost, but there might be but at least you've got the client or the insured with some hope of getting somewhere near their value, which they can, you know, measure against something rather than just saying, what's the replacement value of your house?
As an ex-real estate agent, I'll say that real estate agents have no idea about that.
They get closer to most people than they do with their insurance values, I bet you.
We have another question up the front, but just while we're moving there, I'd just like to follow on from that discussion, Jim. One of the issues that discussed in the paper, and it's been mentioned a couple of times today, is the impact on and involvement of lending institutions around around flood and the availability of mortgage insurance. It seems to be a very important piece that we must... And I'd just like to...
Yes, thanks, Rick, and thanks, everybody. I suppose in my past I also had a period of being involved in lending, so this is a bit of an interest to me as well. We talked about risk mitigation, and as John Trowbridge said, mitigation's been, you know, obviously we see that as the prime, you know, huge importance. We talk about controlling councils and so on and so on, but these buildings, and we saw Emerald, Roma, Charlton listed on the screen, Rob's presentation today, who lent on those things? So why are we lending on high-risk properties? And if we are lending on high-risk properties, what's the obligation for people to have and maintain flood insurance? What are the capital obligations on the lenders? Are there higher capital obligations on lenders to do that? Because a developer or a council or whatever will not get a development away if the buyers do not have the ability to buy the property. So we've just had a whole drama here in Australia around unsustainable lending to people who had no ability to pay those loans in financial services. And we've actually got a failure of a similar kind here. We're setting people up to fail. I think that there's a role that we're thinking about that lenders can play here by choking off the supply of funds or constraining the supply of funds for high-risk type development. It hasn't featured outside of John's introductory comments once in the discussion today.
Thanks. I do think it is a large gap and there's a role to play there. Are there any bank people here? Any people? Yeah. Well, there you go. We have a question from the audience.
My question is directed to John. I'm David Sargent from Professional Financial Solutions. John, in the in your paper presentation this morning, discussing the compulsory option, when you talked about the affordability issue, it looked as though there was a whole lot of questions around that in terms of actually addressing how you make this affordable. And it looked... there's a lot to be very complex to administer the compulsory option. And I just wondered who you envisage to carry the costs or bear the cost of actually the administration. It looks like it would be administered through the insurers. So would it be the insurers who actually are carrying the costs of the administration?
Excuse me. David, I think you're talking about the automatic option,
that's
the
right.
automatic cover with or without opt-out, rather than compulsion.
Sorry, with the automatic cover with the...
Yeah, well, if there's going to be any kind of discount or subsidy given to high-risk properties, somebody has got to be working out what that discount is. So you, it leads you to the idea of some kind of reinsurer-type body that I refer to as the flood insurance pool. And that is the body that would need to, if you like, administer all of this. It's also, you know, when you listen to Rob and others talk about risk mitigation and the need to interact with councils, perhaps state governments and others, you say, well, how is that going to happen too? You can't have the insurance industry on its own has been working very hard around the NFID and other things, but there's no formal place where the two can meet together. So you can conceive of the flood insurance pool as being the central place where all of these things are managed from or are supported from. And I think if we're going to get real progress on mitigation, for example, and on national approach to flood mapping and so on, then something like that needs to happen. So that's the sort of thing that we had in mind. But we're really awaiting other people's views around this in the submissions to help us to try and take that to the next step.
Thanks. Just while we're moving to another question in the audience, I've got one of the questions on SMSs to you, Rob. Is what proportion from your slides, you had 85% of accepted Brisbane claims. What proportion of that 85% were accepted as riverine flood? It's a curly, mate.
I don't have the precise figures on that. I can only say I think the vast majority were accepted either as partial or full riverine flood claims. There were... that's in the Brisbane catchment area. The example of the Lockyer Valley and Toowoomba, for example, the acceptance level there, I think, was 99% and denials were 1%. The reason for that was that it was largely classified as storm, which is fully covered. Sorry, but I don't have that precise figure of the 85%.
That's another question from the audience.
My name's Peter Vinson. I'm a retired actuary and I'm trying to represent the weaker members of the community. There's been lots of reference to councils and decisions that they've made in the past and may make in the future. There's been lots of mention of issues of mitigation, incentives and so on. How do you do it? I suggest that the solution is compulsory insurance and compulsion for full cover. It solves everything. It looks after the weaker members of the community. They can't look after themselves. No matter what all these other things you're talking about happen, they won't look after themselves. They can't. Compulsory insurance should be subsidised heavily. Where there's the high flood risk, high natural disaster risks are the faults of councils. They should be the ones that pay the subsidies, coupled to some extent with state governments. Existing homes are, the homeowners, I would say they're third parties, the other parties being the councils and the state governments. I would say that most homeowners in flood-prone areas are innocent victims of past unfortunate decisions of councils. The councils should be answerable, they should be the ones that pay. Similarly, future homes, if they're high flood risk, the same goes. They should also be eligible for subsidy. The council should be the ones to pay because they're the ones that are doing the approving.
Peter, I'll just follow up on your comment there. I mean, I've read what you've written in the past on this issue, and your proposal that the councils should pay, because that's where the responsibility lies. Inevitably, that'll mean higher rates for sort of lower risk people. And I just wondered about the extent to which you think it's appropriate for for those people who act prudently and build their house on the hill to end up paying because someone else actively and consciously took on the risk of living on a floodplain.
Well, I'm not sure that people did actively and consciously live on a floodplain. I think they were misled. I think they really believed they had low risk. And the councils are the ones that are at fault. Now, I'm a ratepayer. Yeah. I accept that if my council is responsible for its past decisions, I'm going to have to pay. And if they make bad decisions in the future, I should have to pay as well. But by God, I'll vote them out of office.
Yeah. We have another question down here. While we're waiting for the mic to be moved, Rob, I just want to... I think everyone agrees that we don't have enough information. We need flood maps. So some insurers... I think all insurers want to get in... Well, if we're going to 85% coverage, everybody... A lot of insurers are really skilling up on the flood maps. But there's a lot of issues around commercial in confidence with that information. I just wondered... one of the things we see in some overseas jurisdictions is publicly available flood mapping. And I just wondered what the sort of the insurance industry's perspective is on having how to move from the current situation of commercial and confidentially held information to a system where every user of a flood map can access the same information.
Okay. Just very briefly replying to that gentleman's point, which I take seriously. Just flaw in the argument is insurance doesn't stop floods. The floods will reoccur, and having a compulsory insurance won't stop the floods coming down the river. And one of the things we should all remember is it's not just properties and costs of properties and assets that get affected by floods. People die, and quite a few did in the last flood. So that's why mitigation is doubly important. That stops floods. Okay, now.
I think there's an enormous agreement that, to follow up on Peter's comment, the point you've made, is that mitigation is necessary and no one is going to disagree with that. However, everyone agrees that there's some period from where we are now to having the mitigation measures in place. Now, you'd be aware of the impact that a flood of, say, the 1867 level would have on the Nepean Hawkesbury Plains. I mean, I've been told by people in the engineering profession that mitigation cannot solve that issue because it's such a large issue.
I don't disagree. There are things that you can't do because the nature is always going to be stronger than you are. Yeah. But you can certainly work the problem. And by thinking that this is just a single view that we say mitigate, it's not. We actually do provide insurance out in the marketplace increasingly, as my slides showed. There is almost an exponential growth in the number of policies available in the marketplace to consumers of all risk levels in the market that cover flood. So we're not saying, no, we'll just wait until it's all mitigated. We have got insurance out there. It is available. And, yes, there will be people who will find it difficult to afford at the extreme end, and that's where the subsidy issue, acknowledge that there is that. So we work the problem today, but we don't take our eye off tomorrow because what we want to do is get rid of the problem so it doesn't happen again. Or if it does, it happens at such a minimal level of damage and effect that it's no longer the issue that it is today. That's the way forward from our point of view anyway. Flood information. We've argued for some time through this process with the government that comprehensive, accurate flood data across the country is in fact an infrastructure asset that should be owned by the government and monitored and managed by a body within the government. Bureau of Meteorology is one that comes to mind. They're responsible for putting out flood warnings, etc. So why would they not have carriage of the flood mapping exercise in Australia? Now, it's a large investment to get it done properly. It's high technology to get it done accurately. All we have done is try to address the problem from an insurance perspective to say, what was the key component that prevented more insurers getting into the marketplace to offer flood? This was what we looked at 5 years ago. Flood information was the key component. So what did we do about it? We invested in NFID, which went around council by council laboriously and largely through the work of Carl Sullivan and his team in the Insurance Council, to garner all that information from councils through lengthy negotiations to put it into a structure that could be used by insurers to underwrite. Some insurers, such as Suncorp, went and invested their own funds as well. Now, that's a proprietary database because we've built it for the purposes of insurers to provide flood cover. But we also argue and understand that a more comprehensive, detailed and sophisticated system of flood information across the country, and it doesn't have to be restricted to flood, by the way, it could be other disasters and natural events as well, is a national asset and should be part of the national infrastructure framework and should be managed appropriately. As I said before, what we've got today is a cobbled together approach, which is a cottage industry approach to what is a serious, complex problem that affects the country nationally. Look how much money the country lost in Queensland as a consequence of the mines being flooded, the ports going out of function, the railways being destroyed, the road bridges, etc., destroyed, billions upon billions upon billions of dollars. Surely it's worth investing in a decent database to understand that risk.
I think we'd all agree with that. Tony.
Two questions, a short one and a slightly longer one. It's Tony Coleman. Given that everyone seems to agree the information for a national flood database is a good thing, I guess I'd just like to understand, is there a legal impediment to changing the system where councils appear to have the responsibility for that, moving it away from what's been called a cottage industry to probably putting it in the hands of a national body? And why is it that some councils seem to be able to not provide the information at their discretion? That'd be the first question. The second question is, if we extend the thinking we've been talking about today just a little bit into essentially action by the sea and inundation in particular, or possibly even to highly flood-prone properties, say 1 in 20 a year or worse, we get into a situation where there's actually another part of the problem which we haven't even talked about today, where if you take the view that a property is going to slide into the sea and it has considerable value if it's a waterfront property, a very large part of the value of that property, of course, is the current value of its land and not the value of the building on it. And, of course, the insurance industry only insures the value of the building on it. They never insure the value of the land. And so there's a large compensation problem likely to explode in that area as well, which is not dissimilar to the problem you've got if you want to effectively, shall we say, buy back or prevent resettlement in very highly exposed flood areas as well. Because you've got the value of the land to deal with. And the question really is, to what extent has the panel thought about that or going to make recommendations about it?
I'll try and respond to those questions, Tony. In relation to to the responsibility for flood mapping, as I understand it, it currently comes through the general responsibilities that councils have. And so the responsibility is with them. But there is state government involvement in some cases. Rob probably knows more about it than I do. I suspect the impediments are more of a political nature, an administrative nature, than a legal nature. But at the same time, it's probably to improve all that may well need some legislation as well.
Look, I think that's right. State governments have part of the action, but certainly in Queensland, for example, I don't think they have very much power at all. It is vested in the local government, and there are many and varied reasons why they're disinclined to provide the information to the database. I am aware that the Attorney General's Department, however, federally is looking at this, and they are looking at a way of essentially what we would argue is the better way to go about it is collating all the information that's available today, doing a gap analysis on what needs to be provided, and then instituting an appropriate mechanism to be able to get that information in a central location that is accessible to all those who need it. And it's not just the insurers, it's across the entire economy and the community at large.
We have heard that some of the councils are worried about the integrity of the data, and therefore they're worried about being sued if they provide data that's either outdated or not accurate. So that's an issue that needs dealing with.
And John referred in his presentation to some of the different interests of state and local governments in which impacts upon the information that's provided.
Rob is right to refer to the Attorney General's Department. This is the source of the National Disaster Resilience Strategy. And really what we are doing on the panel is a piece of a wider picture about national resilience and national disaster recovery and resilience. Mm. And it is quite possible that partly with the stimulus of our output, that there will be more pressure put on by the Commonwealth on the states and councils, because the state, irrespective of the current legal position, the federal government's always got the whip hand when it comes to the purse strings, and so that's one of the reasons why I'm optimistic that we'll get progress in this area, irrespective of what the particularities are today. I'm not sure if I want to comment on Tony's other question about fancy properties on hilltops by the sea. We know you're a climate change person, Tony, and there'll be an issue there possibly one day. But I think we've got our hands full as it is.
Okay. Well, federal government has got its whip hand. I'm in a lucky position of being able to ignore Brent Walker now. I've got the whip hand on the time, Brent, and I'll just have one short question and then we need to close.
It's just very short, Brent Walker. Isn't the problem with flood mapping that it's got to be dynamic? Because the properties downstream are always going to be affected by developments upstream, and development is always going on upstream, besides any other effect that climate or whatever might have.
Just to follow through on that, the Attorney General's Department, I think about 10 years ago, funded Geoscience Australia to work with Australian National University to develop ANUGA, which was a flood model to be given to councils. And what we haven't had is council take-up. And one of the aspects of that model, which is that it is a dynamic model. So I think it's a very good point, Brent. We need to close up now. I just want to make a couple of high-level sort of consensus decisions based on what we've heard today. Then I want to give John the opportunity to just give his feedback. So I think we all agree that mitigation is necessary. So we need to improve national resilience. And I think we all welcome not only that the federal government and the state governments are looking at this issue seriously. And I think now, if every generation comes up against this issue, I hope we are the generation that does something about it. But we need goodwill from every stakeholder. So we agree, everyone agrees on mitigation. Everyone agrees that everyone agrees on flood mapping. I think what mitigation is a very complex area, but I think we'd kind of all agree that we should try and stop building in flood zones. And so I think there's a high level of agreement around a lot of these issues. There is some difference, say, between the insurance industry and the consumer reps and probably the government about whether the flood insurance market is functioning to the level that it needs to provide that social good of insurance. I think and I hope that the differences are around the edges and that the different perspectives will come together for something that may, Rob, in the shorter term, lead to some form of insurance solution whilst we're putting in place those mitigation measures that I think we as a country, everybody in this room, would agree that are needed. So that's the close. I'd just like to give anyone in the panel an opportunity for short closing remarks, and then John at the end if he wants to say something.
I'll just... Oh, sorry.
No, you're right.
I just wanted to raise one point that we're very quick to knock out compulsion, and the idea that compulsion removes incentive for mitigation is not entirely correct, and particularly if we followed Peter's model, if the councils have to pay, by nature of having to pay, they've got some incentive to mitigate. So I think compulsion, as opposed to automatic cover, is a very difficult issue, but I don't think it's one that we should necessarily automatically rule out.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to say consumer confidence in the wider insurance industry is absolutely critical, and it has been severely dented. We must create confidence, certainty at claim time as to what people are covered. I endorse the comments made earlier about people understanding what covers they've got. They don't. We've heard that in spades. The feedback today has been very helpful. Thank you.
I'll just add a couple of things. In terms of the issues that the panel's got to consider, I'm really pleased that it does cover broader issues around affordability, accessibility, and particularly the issues for low-income households and tenants and contents insurance, because I think these are issues that can be also addressed while we've got this opportunity.
I'd just like to say thanks for your input and keep it coming.
Thanks.
I probably said more than enough today, but I'd only reiterate that the complexity of this problem demands that we actually go to the heart of it and attack the drivers of the problem. And unless we do that, then we will be back again in the next generation or wherever the next event occurs. And I would argue that the industry is getting on with that. It has made substantial progress. It will continue to do so. And it will be able to provide the necessary cover in the marketplace. We do need assistance in a very small section of the market, but I think at the end of the day, we're able to provide the solution.
Just one comment before I make my closing remarks, and that is there were many questions on the screen here that came through on SMS. Rick, we didn't get time to deal with those.
Yes.
And I would like a copy of those so we can see what the questions are, because that's part of our input. And if there's anybody who wants an answer now from the panel about on any of those questions, would you let us know? All of that apropos of an extension of what John just said, which is keep it coming. That's what we, as you know, we've got submissions closing next week. There are lots of difficult issues, that's clear. It's been a really good session this morning with a lot of input. What I would encourage you to do, if you've got ideas about all this that can help us carry this forward, and you don't think you can get that idea fully formed or fully written out or fully developed by the 14th of July, which is our submission closing date, then send us where you are anyway, because we, to the extent that you've got ideas that we would like to follow up on, then we will follow up on. I'd really like to encourage written input from any of you here who would like to make it. And it doesn't matter if it's only a couple of paragraphs or if it's 50 pages. It doesn't matter. We're interested in trying to... we're still... you can see this debate over what the real issues are, but we will come to a position on those. And once we do, then there'll be a range of practical implementation and theoretical questions that we still have to deal with. So on that note, may I say thank you very much to the Institute and the Insurance Council as joint sponsor here, and we're delighted that you got such a good turnout, and we've valued the input the panel has. I know that from talking to Jim and John as well, and we hope we get some good submissions.
They mic'd me up, mate. I'm right. I really want to thank the panel. We've got... we've only touched the surface today on these issues, but we've run out of time. So I've got three more things that I have to do. I want to thank the panel and give you something to watch, something to drink while you're watching the State of Origin tonight, the Mighty Blues. And then I want to say, just ask people to fill out the questionnaires before you leave. And then I just want to invite Barry up to make his clothes while I'm giving you guys your grog.